Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire's Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant used to have some company in neighboring states. Today, it's the last one standing. Maine Yankee shut down 2 decades ago. Vermont Yankee stopped generating power 2 years ago. And in Massachusetts, the Pilgrim Nuclear Facility will close before 2020. Some see this nuclear decline as cause for celebration, given long-held safety concerns about atomic energy, shown in full color 6 years ago after Japan's disaster at its Fukushima plant. But others say nuclear's demise is nothing to celebrate because less nuclear in New England could mean more carbon, since most of those nuclear-generated kilowatts are likely to be replaced by natural gas. Today in The Exchange, a new perspective on an old argument, nuclear power. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests for the hour. Ray Shaddis is with us, consulting technical advisor for the New England Coalition on Nuclear Pollution and vice president for legal initiatives. He's been involved in anti-nuclear campaigns around the region. He joins us from Maine. Ray, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
It's great. I'm glad to be here.
Jim Connell is also here, associate professor of physics at UNH. He teaches a course called Myths and Misconceptions about Nuclear Science. And Jim Connell, it's good to have you, too. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us, Armin Cohen, executive director at the Clean Air Task Force, which focuses on combating climate change through the development of other low-carbon sources. And Armin, welcome. Really nice to see you.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, and Armin, I wanted to start with you. How do you view broadly this nuclear demise here in New England?
So it's an interesting history. I actually was part of the legal coalition that fought against the licensing of Seabrook back in the 80s. But I've changed my views on that, on nuclear in general, because of the climate challenge. So we are moving towards climate disaster pretty rapidly. Nuclear energy, for all of its concerns, is the world's largest non-carbon source of electricity. In New England, provides about 30% of New England's power and the vast majority of its low-carbon electricity. So nuclear has been rethought by folks in the environmental movement, including me, with all the concerns and caveats that need to be addressed, as probably an extremely important tool in combating climate change by displacing fossil fuels.
Well, that's a really interesting personal history, that you started off opposing the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant here in New England, and you've kind of turned around because of climate.
Yeah, I think it really, back in the 80s, climate really wasn't at the top of the list of environmental concerns. Now we know a lot more. It's also the fact that, and we can talk about this later, I think the current generation of nuclear plants look not to be really the future. There's a good deal of technological development that promises much greater safety, much lower cost, a much less problematic waste profile. So a lot of things have changed, both climate and the emergence of a class of technologies which we think may be vastly superior to the ones we have now.
What's this been like for you among your environmental colleagues? Is there a split in the environmental movement on this?
You know, that's probably an extreme way of stating it. I think there are a number of folks who just don't like nuclear almost on principle. But there's a great deal of discussion now among climate advocates as to the role of nuclear. It sort of helps that the Obama administration's mid-century climate plan had a very large role for nuclear. The IPCC, which is the UN's body on this topic, has put nuclear forward as part of a solution, as part of a solution set, along with wind and solar. So the conversation, I think, is getting a lot more fluid. I think folks are looking at the upsides and downsides and, you know, not trying to glamorize the technology either.
Well, and we'll definitely talk about some of the risks and some of these newer nuclear plants that you mentioned, Armin. But, Ray, how do you see it?
Well, nuclear might provide some tiny portion of a solution to global warming, but it cannot be a major player simply because of the cost of setting out sufficient number of nuclear plants to offset any reasonable amount of gas emissions.
Cost in terms of dollars or cost in terms of risk to the public, Ray?
Well, you know, the risk to the public is debatable. What's not debatable is that nuclear plants are shutting down left and right because they are no longer cost effective. And, you know, promises for nuclear development, new designs and so on, are just that. They're promises. And like the promises of the first generation of nuclear plants, they may not, those promises may not be kept.
You've long been involved, Ray, in anti-nuclear events, efforts here in New England, Seabrook, Vermont Yankee, and we'll talk later about your ongoing efforts concerning the shutdown of Vermont Yankee. How do you view, then, this nuclear decline here in New England?
Well, it's inevitable. I mean, it's very, very simply inevitable. You know, nuclear plants may be beautiful, beautiful physics, but they're a plumber's nightmare. I mean, tens of thousands of valves, some automated, some not, relay switches that go bad, just like the ones in your household. And the plants are complicated beyond belief. The ones that have been shut down have been shut down for two reasons. One is that nuclear accidents around the world resulted in increased safety requirements. Nuclear safety is expensive. And the wear and tear on nuclear components has far exceeded early expectations, so that maintenance costs have risen to a point where nuclear simply cannot compete with natural gas, coal, or hydro, or now we have the rise of photovoltaics,
solar,
and wind power.
Well, yeah. And so sounds good on paper, Professor Connell, but is a plumber's nightmare. So looks great, you know, in the classroom where you work. But Ray is saying, when you get right down to it, there are a lot of tubes and pipes and things that can go wrong. I just wonder broadly, first of all, how much these nuclear kilowatts going offline have affected New England's power grid. Does less nuclear mean more natural gas, for example?
That's typically the case. It's always a little hard nowadays to tell where power is coming from. We have a national grid. And as opposed to 20 years ago, we're much more likely to get power from California than we were at that time. So power is sold back and forth across the country in a way that wasn't true in the past. So it's a little harder to say what a regional effect is.
Go ahead, Armin.
If I can jump in, we recently looked at the question of the putting Pilgrim aside, which is scheduled to be shut, what would be the replacement in terms of renewable energy potential for the remaining units in New England, which are Millstone and Seabrook? Millstone is in Connecticut, two-unit plant in Connecticut. The calculation says that if we put all the wind and solar that's in the queue right now, to be online or has been proposed, much of which never actually gets, and particularly the wind power, never actually gets to be built because of opposition and various issues. But assuming that all of that comes online, we wouldn't be able to replace Millstone and Seabrook in terms of zero carbon kilowatt hours. So if you took Millstone and, say, Seabrook offline, you would basically go backwards a decade in terms of your ability to abate carbon. So the replacement is probably going to be fossil fuels in the sort of 10, 15-year time frame. Now, farther out there, you might say, well, eventually we'll replace Millstone and Seabrook with wind and solar, but then you've lost 10 years of climate progress in the process. So, I mean, I think there are two timescales to think about here. The problem with carbon is once you put it in the atmosphere, it's there for effectively ever. So that decade of additional carbon is going to be around for many centuries.
How do you view, Jim, this decline of nuclear energy here in New England? Again, we talked about the plants that have gone offline or are soon to go offline. Just broadly, how do you view it?
Well, part of it is, of course, an issue of age. These reactors are old reactors. They have a finite life. Seabrook is relatively new, but we say new, you know, no reactors until just recently in the U.S. were licensed until I think the last was 1996. So there's no such thing as a young nuclear plant until the Tennessee plant opened last year. So that's part of it. I mean, power plants have a finite age, be it coal or nuclear or natural gas. Certainly, there are newer reactors in other countries. China, for example, is going nuclear in a very big way. The number of nuclear plants overall has declined only relatively slightly. I think we're back at exactly 100 now with the new Tennessee plant.
Nationally. Is there a different ethic around nuclear here in New England? I'll throw this to you first, Jim, but I want to hear from everybody, because there is that new plant that opened up in Tennessee, first one in decades, first new nuclear facility. There are at least three, if not four, coming online in South Carolina and Georgia. Four, okay. So, Jim, what do you think? Do people here in New England feel differently about nuclear than in other parts of the country?
Well, I can speak more to my experience with students than the general population students who have taken my class. What I think is interesting is they are less polarized. They are less avidly pro, less avidly negative on nuclear power. And I've seen this change over the last 15 years as I've taught this class. They tend to be more open to the notion that there's pro aspects and negative aspects to the technology, and they tend to be less doctrinaire about these issues.
Why do you think that's the case, Jim?
I honestly don't know. It's, to me, fascinating to see.
What do you think? I want to get Ray back into this, too, Armin. Hang on one second, okay?
Lord, just as for my personal anecdote suggests, folks like me who are in their late 50s, we sort of grew up in the sort of Three Mile Island, sort of Chernobyl period. And there was a lot of anti-nuclear activity in the 70s. And I think, you know, folks of my generation kind of come to this with a certain cultural bias. I know I certainly did.
Well, in Chernobyl.
Yeah. Big machines, you know, and Ray's points are very good. You know, these are complicated machines. The new generation promises to be substantially less complicated. But as Ray points out, that's still a promise to be shown. So I think that there is I see a generational split in my travels around the country and also to some extent in New England, where older folks maybe are a little less open. Young folks are saying, well, maybe the major challenge on the planet right now environmentally is climate. Nuclear accidents are a risk. You know, if we look at the objective record as to what happened at Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and Fukushima in terms of actual, you know, mortality, those are issues, real issues to be confronted. But climate is another set of issues to be confronted. So I find a more balanced and nuanced discussion. I think the younger generation that I talk to also, you know, is as the gentleman before me said, it's not black and white. The view is, you know, we're probably going to need everything to solve climate. Wind, solar, let's go gangbusters on that. But nuclear provides a 24/7, you know, on-demand power source. We can get into the sort of why 100% renewables probably is a very risky course. And that's kind of how I got to this point. I find more students I talk to appreciate that.
Yeah, Ray, let's hear from you too. Either regional differences or generational differences.
We've gone a ways down the road. You know, I just, with respect to the young folks, you know, I work with church groups, and I'm involved in partisan politics and issues generally other than nuclear. And I think my experience is that young people are less polarized, indeed less committed on every issue. It's a detached generation. So, you know, if they're going, you know, trying an even-handed approach this way, that way on nuclear, I don't know that it's particularly significant to the future of nuclear.
What about regional differences, Ray? We talked a moment ago about, you know, again, five plants now being built or already up and running in the South, and things are closing down here in New England. I'd love your thoughts on regional differences.
When Maine Yankee was on the ropes, we hired in some management people from Entergy Corporation, which is headquartered in New Orleans. And They were shocked at the reception they got. They had in New Orleans, Mississippi, you know, the whole southern stretch. There was literally no real opposition to any nuclear activity. There was little criticism on safety issues or on issues of nuclear pollution, and here in New England, you know, they were met with skepticism, and people wanted to know the facts. So it was remarkably different. I think the history of the deployment of nuclear in New England, you know, may feed into that. I mean, Seabrook was a defining moment in the struggle over nuclear power, and I think it did affect people throughout New England.
Lots of protests and lots of delays in terms of getting the plant running.
Just protests. You know, the protests are something that I personally don't care for. Building of Seabrook, the licensing of Seabrook, the licensing of Maine Yankee were challenged through the judicial process, through the hearing process at the Atomic Energy Commission and then at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. You know, this is the best tradition of redress of grievances of people with access to their government. And the conversation was not the emotional conversation of protest. It was the rational conversation of the courtroom.
Again, our phone number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, the number, 1-800-892-6477. And Armand, you mentioned earlier, seemed to be saying that if nuclear energy, given the climate challenge, nuclear energy is needed to fill the gap that wind and solar and tidal and other sources couldn't fill that gap on their own. Am I understanding you right on that point?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the, by the way, I just want to say I salute Ray and his efforts. I think we absolutely need the sort of watchdog around safety issues that his group and others provided. But we can get into this later. Most of the studies that have been done have suggested wind and solar can provide a very, very significant contribution to phasing out fossil fuels from the power grid. The problem that we keep running up against are days like this in New Hampshire where it's very dark and rainy and we're not going to have the solar plant and solar cells operating. And that often goes on for weeks. Storage is not necessarily going to solve that problem.
Batteries are getting better. Maybe we can pick that up after a break, Garmin.
Yeah.
All right. Stay with us. We'll talk more about nuclear power here in New England. We'll start taking your calls too, 1-800-892-6477.
A young man and woman fall in love while traveling across Europe in Joseph Monninger's new novel, but he says making that seem interesting on the page is not that easy.
Being in love isn't really that interesting. It's the before and after that really kind of brings the impact.
I'm Peter Biello. Joseph Monninger and I speak about his new book and writing about love on The Bookshelf from NHPR. Find this and all of NHPR's podcasts wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, nuclear power in New England. With plants shutting down in our region but opening up down south, we take another look at nuclear power. Is it a carbon-free energy source we should embrace, or is it too expensive and dangerous? The Exchange number for you to join us with your comments and thoughts, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Armin Cohen, Jim Connell, Ray Shattis, let's go to our listeners now. And Natalie joins us from Newburyport. Hi, Natalie. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Hi, everybody.
Go ahead.
So I'm the executive director of an organization called the C10 Foundation, and that stands for Citizens Within the 10-Mile Radius of Seabrook. And we've been operating a radiological airborne monitoring network within the planning zone since Seabrook went online in 1991. We're funded to do that in Massachusetts by the Department of Public Health, not yet in New Hampshire. We're hoping to change that. But as your listeners know, the plant is aging, and as folks probably are aware, there's some serious concrete problems at the plant as well. So those are some things that our board and our organization is involved with, because there are definitely some public safety concerns for people to think about living near a nuclear power plant, and there's also the issue of waste. So when Armand and Jim might talk about the cleanness of nuclear, it's really important to think about the waste that never goes away.
We'll definitely talk about the waste. If I could ask you, Natalie, just broadly, since you're involved in this issue, and thank you very much for calling in. How do you feel about the bigger picture? We've talked about the aging plants and leaks and cracks and pipes. And one of our guests said, it can be a plumber's nightmare. But broadly, how do you weigh this climate challenge versus some of the risks you see with nuclear power?
Well, Laura, I think the last time I called into your show, I was working for a regional energy efficiency group. Mm-hmm. And New Hampshire is a state that has made some important strides in energy efficiency as the cleanest, cheapest way to meet energy demand. We've talked a little bit about the issue of energy storage, but to your south, Massachusetts is one of the leading nations of, along with California, at really driving the energy storage, not just through chemical batteries, but other methods as well. And what that can do is make the intermittent power supply of renewables, match up well, so that it doesn't matter if it's a cloudy day, you've got the storage. So, states, leading parts of the country and the world are really launching ahead with that. So, yes, nuclear is an important part of our energy mix here in the region. I think it's about 60% if you added up the New Hampshire's energy needs. But I think that the region would be wise to think about, alternatives beyond Seabrook. It is licensed now. It's operating. We don't know how long the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will see it safe to operate. So it's just important for our region and our economy to think about other paths forward.
So do you think, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but Natalie, do you think we're being a little bit lazy in terms of improving efficiency, improving storage of these alternatives, and turning too quickly to nuclear?
I don't think we're turning quickly to nuclear. I think that, you know, that while there are parts of the country that are building newer plants, and we historically have some of the older aging plants, and Seabrook's the only one left in the region still going, I think that it is important, as Ray was saying, to educate the next generation about nuclear power and what it means. Certainly there are climate risks and health risks of all kinds of energy that we produce. But I think that it's important for the public to get educated about the pros and cons. And I think that nobody that I know objects to going to more clean, renewable, and energy-efficient ways of using energy. So.
Okay. Well, Natalie, good to hear from you. And I actually want to bring everybody in on this. Maybe you first, Ray, the idea that there are alternatives, including conservation, that we could be looking at more strongly instead of saying, you know, let's go with nuclear.
Well, the alternatives are making themselves heard. The alternatives are bringing themselves forward in the free marketplace, and where, for example, where energy storage was a big bugaboo for renewables, you know, we now have the development of domestic batteries that can carry a photovoltaic system through the nighttime, and the prices on all of it are falling. I think for a simple comparison, where nuclear is not living up to its projections, the renewables are exceeding all projections. And so we have some great hope there. I do want to just address one issue though, in terms of the reluctance to rely on gas-fired generation, and that is that on the whole, gas-fired plants produce about one-half of the carbon emissions that coal-fired plants produce. The quickest, most effective way to reduce carbon emissions overall is to substitute, in this market at least, is to substitute gas plants for coal plants.
And that's largely what's been happening, right, Ray?
That's what the market is remarkably benign toward the environment in recent years. And so, you know, this is what the reality is. A gas plant can be designed, licensed, and started up in about 3 years. For about, I'm taking a ballpark here, about one-sixth the price of an equivalent output nuclear plant.
Nuclear plants famously take a long time to get approved and a long time to get built. And hold on, Ray, because I want to bring our other guests in. Go ahead, Arnold.
I take Ray's point, but the problem with replacing coal with gas is that we're just going to cook the planet a little bit more slowly. Half of coal is not very good in terms of an emissions profile. We really need, what the science is telling us is we need to be at a zero carbon grid by, you know, roughly mid-century, you know, 2060, somewhere in there, if we're going to avoid the worst effects of climate change. Globally, you know, China, India are still building coal massively. Replacing those coal plants with gas, it's going to slow warming just a tad, but it's really not going to get us on that steep decline. That's why we really need to be looking at the zero carbon power sources. And in the short term, I agree with Natalie, in the short term, there's no doubt that the existing nuclear plants are abating a lot of carbon. I think the questions are legitimate as going forward, what is nuclear's role? But if I believed that we could go 100% wind and solar with storage and that was a slam dunk, I would be 110% on board. The evidence suggests that's really going to be a big slog, and there are some really intractable problems associated with that. Ray mentioned storage. Natalie mentioned storage. Again, as I said before the break, with a typical battery array, we're talking about storing energy over, say, a period of 7 to 10 hours and then discharging it. But in New England in particular, really anywhere in the northern climes, you get days, multiple days, weeks, even months of extremely low solar or wind. You don't have anything to store in that situation. And so you're kind of chasing your tail. You need something that's on demand. Now, my argument is that the way to build a zero-carbon grid in New England and elsewhere would be to have a firm zero-carbon base. It could be nuclear. It could be gas power plants with carbon capture and storage. But you're going to need something to provide that 24/7 availability. Renewables can cycle on top of that, and you can do storage and renewables. It's a complicated topic, but storage is not a silver bullet.
Well, and on this issue of nuclear storage, the storage of the waste, Nick in Conway sends us an email saying, there is no solution to long-term storage and stewardship of high-level domestic nuclear waste. So, Jim, I'm going to ask you a very basic question since you're the professor on our panel. What is nuclear waste, and what's problematic about it?
All right. Nuclear power plants use nuclear fission, we've all heard that, as opposed to fusion, which we don't have yet. When these nuclei split, they produce typically two smaller nuclei, and they release energy. Okay, that's where all this energy comes from. It's about 10 million times more energy than you get from burning, say, natural gas.
10 million?
10 million. That's why a power plant, a nuclear power plant, can run on around 30 tons of fuel a year as opposed to 3 million tons for a coal plant. But those fission products are typically radioactive. And that's one of the key issues in nuclear safety, because you have to keep that out of the environment. It generates heat, which is one of the problems if a reactor shuts down. That's what causes a meltdown if you have a meltdown in a reactor. And it's also what goes into the waste. And so the spent fuel is stored, and then ideally you want to find a long-term storage solution. And in this country, and really in the world, that does not yet exist.
So where does it go, given that long-term storage right now is not being well done, as you're saying?
In this country, almost all of it is still where it was generated, in storage that was originally intended to be temporary at each of the nuclear plants.
On site.
On site.
Yeah.
Look,
go ahead,
I interject. I mean, I think that the waste issue is very legitimate, and but let's have a sense of proportionality here. All of the nuclear waste generated by civilian nuclear power in the United States since 1957 would fit on one soccer field 1.5 feet high. It is toxic material, but it is a limited amount of material. Sweden and Finland are moving forward with permanent repositories. The politics in the U.S. have been horrendous on this issue, in large part due to a very powerful Senate delegation from Nevada. But this is a political problem. It is not fundamentally a physical management problem. We know what the options are. Sweden and Finland, as I mentioned, are moving forward with permanent repositories. Is there zero risk? No. But it is a solvable problem. And I would argue that dealing with a soccer field or a couple soccer fields of waste is a relatively small price to pay for a very significant contribution to a zero carbon grid.
Ray, can you recycle the waste?
Yeah,
can you recycle it, Ray?
I'm practically out of my seat here losing it. because you know, these analogies are really false analogies. The idea that a small amount of concentrated poison is not a problem when compared to a large amount of dilute poison is really a false analogy. To begin with, the nuclear fuel that's burned in these plants is a concentrate from naturally occurring uranium in uranium ore, and it really amounts to a really tiny fraction of the original ore that was removed from the mine. So that 99%+ of nuclear waste is left at the mine or at the milling plant or as mill tailings or at the enrichment plant. And that has to be dealt with no less than the concentrated uranium and uranium byproducts, if you will.
Well, speaking of that cycle, I'm glad you mentioned that, Ray, because we got an email here from Christy who says, stop perpetuating the myth that nuclear is a non-carbon emitting source of energy. Christy says, when you look at the fuel cycle alone, you see that the, and this is what you mentioned, Ray, the mining, milling, and enriching processes require massive amounts of energy. Currently coal-generated energy that has a massive carbon footprint. Then Christy says, let's look at construction, years of use of carbon-generating energy used to build, hundreds of thousands of tons of cement, one of the highest carbon footprint construction materials, Christy mentions, gasoline fuel construction vehicles. And then Christy says, some estimates are that a nuclear plant needs to be run at 100% power for 20-plus years to make up for its carbon footprint. What plants operate at 100% for 20 years? Christy, thank you for the email. And Jim Connell, I'll turn to you on that. I have heard others make this argument that Christy makes that, you know, maybe there's not much carbon emitted in terms of the energy that the plant produces, but to create that plant in the first place requires a lot of carbon.
Typically, to run a 1,000 megawatt plant for a year, you need to dig up about 85,000 tons of ore. And then, as Ray says, that's refined into the 30 tons or so that is the plant. Now, most of that is not uranium and thorium, so it's not radioactive. What's left is slightly radioactive. So in terms of the volume, Ray is correct. You have a lot more volume of radioactive waste from that process, some of which has not been managed very well. But in terms of the activity, the total amount of radioactivity, that is very small compared to what comes out of the plants.
Laura, on the point about life cycle analysis, the caller is correct. That's the right way to look at it. You have to look at energy and carbon in. However, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the United Nations authoritative body on climate questions, in its last mitigation report, looked exactly at this issue, looked at hundreds of studies from around the world that have examined this question. Their conclusion was, with all of the energy inputs and associated carbon, nuclear ranks right with wind and solar.
Really?
In terms of all the carbon impacts
that Christy mentions.
Correct. In terms of life cycle analysis, you can go to the report. It's the AR5 mitigation report. It's very clear. So the argument is valid, but the numbers would suggest that on a truly life cycle basis, nuclear is very low in profile.
Can we agree that nuclear is not a zero carbon emitter in the fuel cycle, that it is maybe a low carbon emitter but not a zero carbon?
Yeah, absolutely, Ray. I think it's a question of where does it stand relative to other options.
Yeah. We should stop saying then that nuclear plants are carbon free.
Although if we say that, Ray, we have to say wind plants aren't carbon free. We have to stop saying wind plants are carbon free because there's energy that goes into creating the wind plant. I don't think that's a productive argument. Perhaps we can just say low carbon versus high carbon.
Well, Ray, and here's an email that came in that I'd like to throw to you and our other guests as well. This is from Howard, who used to work as an engineer at Vermont Yankee. So, Howard, thank you for the email. He sent it in early this morning. He talks about radiation. He says, underlying the strident opposition to nuclear power is an unrealistic fear of radiation, Howard says. Many have bought the idea that any amount of radiation is dangerous and become fearful to the point of opposing everything. Howard says radiation is a natural force and something to be careful with. A massive quantity will kill in a short time. Large amounts will cause cancer. At low levels, there is a range where there is a, quote, vaccination effect. At very low levels, there's no effect at all. Howard says radiation is just about everywhere. To get a zero radiation environment, scientists had to go deep into salt mines. Howard concludes by saying those in favor of nuclear power have failed to acknowledge that there is genuine fear and there is cause to fear uncontrolled radiation. However, he says, those who are fearful demand perfection, which is not possible in the real world. Howard, thank you so much. And all of you, we'll pick up on his points after a short break. And we'll keep taking your calls and emails. So thank you for all your responses. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the declining role of nuclear energy in New England and what that means. Let's hear from you. Would you like to see this region rely more or less on nuclear? As we've been hearing, plants around the region have been shutting down. No plans to build new ones, although four or five new nuclear plants are being built down south. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So all of you, just before the break, I read a very thoughtful email from Howard, who told us he used to be an engineer at Vermont Yankee. And I'll throw it to all of you, but you first, Ray, I think. Howard's point is, yes, radiation is a problem, but you can't get to a zero radiation environment. And those who demand, those who are fearful demand perfection, which is not possible in the real world. I'd love your thoughts first, Ray, but I want to hear from everybody. Go ahead, Ray.
Well, a couple of points. One, I know of no activist that I work with demands perfection in terms of radiation protection. No, nobody's demands zero, but we do demand greater care than is exhibited. All the discussion about high level, low level waste, low dose radiation, low levels of radiation, you know, skips over the fact that one radioactive molecule lying up against one lung cell in your body or one bone cell, bone marrow cell, is enough to do it. That's all it takes. So other than that, you have to get out and play the numbers. The National Academy of Sciences in 2005 issued a definitive statement on risk from radiation. And they said, for regulatory purposes, there is no dose that is so low that it is risk-free. I have to, I'm paraphrasing here, but that's what they said. You just can't have a radiation dose that's low enough to be risk-free. And while, you know, there are comparative risks, I take far greater risks every time I get in my car than I do living near a nuclear plant. But while you want to compare risk, you also, when it comes to evaluating nuclear, the risk of nuclear, you want to do it from the perspective of the National Academy of Sciences.
Wow.
There is, yeah.
That's pretty impressive. So just state that for us again, what the National Academy of Sciences said about radiation.
I'll try, but again, I'm paraphrasing. What they said is there is, for regulatory purposes, there is no dose, no radiation dose, so low that there is no risk.
Jim Connell, can you jump in either on that point or on Howard's point, who emailed saying, you know, it's not perfect. You can't have perfection in the real world.
All right. Howard's right. You can't have perfection in the real world. We have a natural background of about 300 millirems. In this country, we get higher amounts of radiation mostly because of medical X-rays.
Millirems, I'm guessing, is a measure of
radiation.
Is a measure
of radiation, of dose to a person. I figure when I get on an airplane and fly to Europe, I get about 5 millirems. So this varies tremendously from place to place just because of cosmic rays at higher altitudes. And we get more in New England because particularly we're in the granite state. Granite has uranium and thorium, so we get more radiation here than we might in some other part of the country or the world. So there is no perfection here, and we live in a sea of radiation. I also agree with Ray. I agree with the National Academies. There is no evidence for a threshold for radiation causing cancer.
We can't say this level is okay, but this level is not.
But we can't say that that theory is wrong because we just don't have the data. Fortunately, we don't have a lot of data on radioactive effect, radiation effects on people long term, because very few people have gotten large amounts of radiation. And what we're extrapolating from is things like Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which involve really large doses.
Well, I was going to ask you that. What have we learned, Jim, from those, either those events, you know, the atomic bomb, or more recently, you know, Chernobyl and a couple decades ago and Fukushima 6 years ago? Have we learned anything about radiation impacts? Do you want to take that, Armand?
Yeah, Laura, I mean, I think, you know, look, a nuclear accident is something you want to avoid at all possible costs. But it is interesting that when the UN Scientific Committee looked, this is a massive, you know, multi-researcher peer-reviewed effort, looked at the health impacts of Fukushima, looking and assuming that there is no safe dose, their conclusion, and I'm going to quote directly, was the no discernible increased incidence of radiation-related health effects are expected among exposed members of the public or their descendants. That's a pretty powerful statement for what is considered to be the second most serious nuclear accident in civilian nuclear power. Now, again, as Ray points out, these are based on statistical inferences and models and so forth. But I think it's the point is, yes, there is risk here. The question is whether it's manageable compared to other risks. And I think the evidence is suggesting that even in the cases of accidents, the kinds of exposures we saw are sort of in the same order of magnitude of normal background radiation.
Let's take another call. This is Tim in Portsmouth. Hi, Tim. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I grew up in Hampton. I have some anecdotal information for you. I've worked in construction all my life, currently for the last 20 or so years. And I don't have to work in nuclear plants anymore because I work on old buildings. But I worked at the nuclear plant for quite a long time while it was under construction.
Wow.
The first thing I want to say is, when I went to work at the nuclear plant, I was in the union, the painters union, the local union out of Portsmouth, New Hampshire. We had a little orientation session, and people from the power company, that was public service back then, told us that that nuclear power plant, just one unit of that power plant, which is all they built, was one of the two, if it was a coal plant, would require 100-ton train cars of coal every week. And that may be conservative because I know that our coal-fired power plant on the Merrimack River in Bow, New Hampshire, when it is online, receives 100 cars of coal every week. And I think that's considerably less megawatts than the Seabrook generator. In any event, I want to tell you, the thing is maddeningly, it's crazily overbuilt. I've worked construction all my life. It was unbelievable. The only way that that plant can fail is really basically human error. And as long as we tightly regulate our atomic industry, and so far I think we've done a good job at that, and although there may be cause for concern in the near future, I believe it's a viable alternative.
Well, Tim,
what I want to say is,
yeah, thank you.
Also, want to throw in one other thing. So I'm not either hot or cold on this. I'm just stating some facts. I'm a real environmentalist. I'm a true tree hugger. I have photographs of me hugging trees, and I'm 65 years old. But I'm a pragmatic old man. And to me, the big C is the big enemy. I want to throw
the big C,
out
meaning climate. Tim, I'm going to let you go just in the interest of time. And thank you so much for calling in. And Ray, wow, what do you think about this, as he puts it, an old tree hugger making that trade off between coal and nuclear?
Well, then we're in the same club.
We're old tree hugger club.
Both, I'm a little older than he is, but we're of course we're tree huggers. And who in their right mind wouldn't be? But you know, Seabrook was built with alkali silica reactive concrete. The concrete, which is marvelous to see. You know, the stuff on the containment building there, the reactor containment building, is like 3 feet thick and massive amounts of reinforcement bar and so on. I toured the plant when it was under construction. I got to look at this firsthand. But the concrete is rotting. It's the silica in the aggregate of the concrete is exuding a kind of slime, reacting with the alkali in the concrete and in the environment. And so there are little tiny cracks appearing everywhere. The NRC cannot certify that plant is in compliance with its licensing basis.
NRC is Nuclear Regulatory Commission, right? Yeah, go ahead, Ray.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. You know, to those of us who are active safety proponents, safety advocates, we regard the NRC as not so much protecting people as protecting the plants from the people. But yeah, they.
So Ray, another question for you, if I could ask. Ask you a question, because we're talking a lot about the old plants and Seabrook, and I've read about some of the cracks that you talk about. Are there new plants? And I'm going to ask you this too, Armin, so don't worry. Are there new plants, Ray, that you feel are safer? They're built better in a new way, and they're not old.
There are a lot of improved designs. I don't know what's being deployed in Georgia or in Florida where there are plants under construction or licensed for construction. But on the whole, we're talking about promises, and once again, we are inevitably in for surprises in design defects.
Surprises, and those are unpleasant when you're talking about nuclear power. I want to ask Armin the same question about the safety profile of nuclear plants, whether you've seen that changing, Armin, and what do you think we should do with the old ones that do develop, you know, cracks and so forth?
So, Laura, I think of this as there are three classes of plants. So there's the existing sort of older units, and Seabrook sort of falls into that category. You know, I applaud groups like Ray's and the other caller that are going to be monitoring and holding those plants to account, making sure the NRC is doing its job. That really is that second generation design. We're seeing now a third generation of design being built in the South. These are, I would say, incrementally, significantly improved safety.
Incrementally?
Incrementally. And so, for example, water is stored at the top of the plant so that gravity deals with, you know, in the case of an overheating situation, you have gravity-fed water cooling. So those are the kinds of innovations that are incrementally improved. The real radical change we're seeing is in the fourth generation coming forward. And it's not like this is science fiction. We've actually built a couple demonstration plants in the U.S. One is being built in China right now. These take water out of the equation entirely. Water is the common denominator of the Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, and Fukushima accidents. You had a boil-off situation. The coolant basically disappeared, couldn't cool the reaction. These Generation 4 plants, take water out of the equation and use very different coolants that are much more stable, don't have a boil-off capability at the kind of temperatures we're talking about. Ray is absolutely correct that, you know, massive commercial deployment of these designs is to be seen, but there's a fundamental physics embedded in this fourth generation that promises not only greater safety but lower cost. Most of a nuclear power plant is, in terms of rebar and concrete, is designed to keep water under very high pressure. So that's most of the material, that's most of the cost, that's most of the construction time.
I see. So if you get water out of the equation.
You can operate at atmospheric pressure or close to it. You need a much less elaborate containment facility, and the cost and the complexity goes way down. Hence, a recent study suggested that, you know, and again, this is to be demonstrated, that these non-light water designs have a pretty good chance of coming in very close to the cost of a new natural gas plant.
Interesting. So go ahead, Jim, if you want to jump in on the idea of newer designs and what we do with the old plants. And then I have another question for you, Jim, about fusion versus fission, but go ahead.
Armand is correct. The reactors that are being built in Georgia and North Carolina are the AP1000 design, which is incremental in the sense that it is a pressurized water reactor, which is what most of the reactors in the U.S. are. The rest are boiling water reactors. They're what are called light water reactors as a class. They're the majority of reactors, overwhelming majority of reactors in the world. But they're based actually originally on submarine reactor technology. So there are people who believe that other designs, and I think you're talking about gas-cooled, high-temperature graphite reactors, aren't you?
And molten salt reactors.
And molten salt. So that's the other widely discussed fourth-generation technology. These new reactors, the AP1000s, have a very different containment system that's intended to cool the reactor in the event of a loss of coolant accident, which is what you were discussing in terms of the problem with water. It's pressure, but it's also you have to continue to cool the fuel after you shut down the reactor or it will melt. And that's what happened at Fukushima. That's what happened at Three Mile Island. Well, partial meltdown. That's what happened. Part of what happened at Chernobyl.
So I feel really guilty asking you this with only a minute left, Jim, but I'm going to go for it anyway. Okay, so we've been talking about nuclear fission. That's what we do now. And all the concerns that, you know, you especially, Ray, has brought up, but others as well. What about, Jim, fusion? Isn't that supposed to be the great new thing that is going to provide all the energy we need? And yeah, the holy grail. Thank you.
Basics. In fission, you take heavy nuclei, you break them apart, you get energy. In fission, you break them apart.
Right.
In fusion, you take light nuclei, you force them together.
You fuse them.
You fuse them. That's what happens in the sun. That's where the sun gets its energy. It's where main sequence stars get their energy. Fusion has been about 40 years away for the last 50 years. And I think that's the difficulty. It's proven very difficult to achieve in the lab. You can, or in a power plant. You can do it in a nuclear bomb, but then you need a nuclear weapon to trigger it. So that's where we sort of stand. There's been great progress over the last 50 years, but we're certainly not there yet.
All right, all of you, we have to wrap it up there, and there's so much more we could have talked about. Ray, I really appreciate you taking the time out for us today. Thank you very much.
I'm pleased to do it, and I hope we'll get another shot at it sometime.
Me too. Thank you very much, Ray. Raymond Shattis, Consulting Technical Advisor for the New England Coalition on Nuclear Pollution. Armin Cohen, thank you for making the trip up from the Boston area. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren. Appreciate the spirited discussion.
Armin Cohen, Executive Director of the Clean Air Task Force, and Jim Connell, good to meet you. Thank you for your time. Jim Connell is Associate Professor of Physics at UNH. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.